Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. We're going to dig deep, so be prepared. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert, and today I get to talk with a guest about the monsters of Native America. I have the pleasure of speaking with Clint Stevens, PhD, and he's a professor of Native American literature, also a scholar of Blake and Tolkien, among others, an essayist, and you might find some of his essays in Paul Kingsnorth's Dark Mountain Project. It's a fantastic project full of works on dark ecology, I guess Kingsnorth would say. And Clint is also one hell of an archer, mushroom farmer, I would say. Even experienced in traditional sweat lodges, if I might say so. So, Dr. Professor Stevens, thanks for coming on The Monster Professor.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here. This is going to be fun.
Well, I want to talk about monsters in Native America. And I know that you probably have a ton that you want to talk about. I want to first start with talking about Wendigo, though, because you told me a Wendigo story that freaked me out. And so, do you mind telling our listeners what that story is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. But I want to qualify here that I'm more of a fan of these stories rather than a scholar of them. I've been reading a lot about them and learning about as much as I can, but I'm really a person who's still learning quite a bit, and I think that's important for the listeners to know. But the Wendigo is really a awesome story. There's many of them out there. This is a story that's very common among many of the northern tribes. The Ojibwe tell Wendigo stories. The Cree tell a Wendigo story, the Innu tell a Wendigo story, and the one that I believe you're referring to is the one where there's a woman who is described early on in the story where she's an orphan, but we learn not too long after that that she does have a father, and she tells her husband that her father's going to come for a visit, and there's some ominous quality to her introduction to that, and it turns out that her father is a Wendigo. And what a Wendigo is, there's many different forms of them, but the key feature of a Wendigo is it's a cannibal monster. A lot of the times they're described as being giants, but sometimes Wendigos just have human forms, and you can't tell them apart from ordinary humans except that they're cannibals. And for me, that's one of the qualities that makes them the most terrifying, is that they look just like you and me, but they're not. And so this father of the woman comes, and he shows up at the camp, and it's described that he crawls into their wigwam. And he comes in, and he sits, but he doesn't sit facing the fire. And he simply stays there.
So he's got his back turned to him the whole time.
That's right.
Like, that's something that you hear in a bunch of like these witch stories too, where at the, you know, at the peak or the climax of the Black Mass, that's where they, you know, or the Black Sabbath, you know, they'll all turn their back to the fire, mm-hmm. and then that's mm-hmm. just I don't know why exactly that's the freakiest part to me, mm-hmm. but he's just sitting there with his back to him the whole time.
Yeah, it's a quality that I've seen in a lot of these Wendigo stories and a few other monster stories, in which there's kind of an antipathy between these creatures and the fire. And, you know, as I've tried to make sense of that, there's that quality of fire, which is the essence of human civilization. It's the place around the hearth, you know, the heart of the civilization in which everybody gathers around. And the fact that there's this alienation between the fire and the Wendigo is such a powerful figure. and it just turns up time and time again. And so this Wendigo, he comes and he sits there. And he sits there. And it's described that, you know, he speaks to his grandchildren just as he would normally speak to his grandchildren. But there's always this ominous feeling about him. And he stays with them for a month or two or something like that. And into the stay, the husband realizes that he's not really eating with them. And he eventually realizes he needs to get some food for the Wendigo. And so he tells his wife, I'm going to go get some food for your father. And there's a understanding between that. And it's a side story of it. But he goes out and the next camp is some mile or two away. And he calls one of the fellows out and asks for help. And he ends up killing the man there. And he takes the body back and he brings it back to his father-in-law, Wendigo. And he says, I have some food for you outside. And so the Wendigo goes out there and he says, keep the grandchildren in here because I don't want to splatter anything on them.
So Wendigo's like, oh, he's got good manners.
He does, but you know, the implication there is that he eats like a ravenous animal.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a messy, horrible experience. And he goes out there and he eats. And over the time that he stays there, the husband goes about and gets more food for him. And at the end, what you realize is that this Wendigo is waiting for other Wendigos to show up. And he's, at the end, going to lead all the other Wendigos away from this camp. And the idea is that these Wendigos are going to go away forever. And of course, that's not entirely true because these Wendigos keep showing up. But at least for this one story, it's kind of the farewell to these Wendigos.
That's wicked. Now, my first encounter with Wendigo was either some of the like Lovecraftian kinds of things, you know. And I'm thinking, so Algernon Blackwood had a story called Wendigo, and that had some freaky details I want to ask you about because I don't know what to make of them. And then August Derleth, who picked up where Lovecraft left off, did one called Ithwaka, I think, Ithwaka or something. And it's essentially about a Wendigo. But also Marvel Comics, they had a Wendigo. He was, and so yeah, that, yeah. I can't get his image out of my mind. He's like this huge, he's like Beast on the X-Men, except white and bigger. And so he's this big furry dude who runs on all fours. Every now and then fought with Wolverine. But the more I read about Wendigos elsewhere, I'm thinking maybe they're not hairy or beast. Like, what do you have an image of? Like, is it just like another person who's a cannibal, or what's going on?
Well, I have to say that my first introduction to Wendigo was I think it was X-Men 142 or something like that. I know it was in the 140s, and it was my brother's comic book, and he had his massive collection of comic books that he would never let me look at, but I would sneak looks at it every once in a while, and one of the covers that just totally entranced me was this image of the Wendigo fighting the X-Men, and it's an image of this woman in the foreground, and she's kneeled down on the ground, and she's got her hands up protecting herself from the Wendigo, and the Wendigo is grabbed Wolverine by the legs and spinning him across the forest there. And oh my goodness, I just loved that comic book cover, and I could just stare at that for hours, it seemed like. But Wendigos that I've come to learn through reading these stories of the Native Americans is quite a bit different. You know, it is sometimes, as I said, described as simply a human being that eats human flesh. It's a cannibal. Other times it's described as a giant. A lot of the times they're described as an ice monster, and so they have ice for flesh. And in one story I've read, he kind of tinkles like an icicle when he moves. And he, another quality of the Wendigos is, and this is common in other folklore that I'm sure you're aware of, is they keep their heart elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so this one Wendigo story has the Wendigo keep his heart and the rest of the Wendigo's hearts in a basket that's been lined with down. And you can look down into that basket and see their beating hearts. And the way to kill the Wendigo, you can't do anything against its actual body, but you have to stab the hearts. And the guy is able to kill a whole bunch of Wendigos because he was able to distract the Wendigo and find out exactly where he hid away his basket with the hearts in it. And so he stabbed the hearts of the Wendigo that way. And for me, that's a really beautiful, evocative, visceral scene. There is those hearts beating in that basket lined with down fur to keep them warm in the, wow, the northern wilderness.
That's a lot like, once again, I say once again, we haven't talked about this on this episode yet, but that's like some
we've
of the
talked
Russian...
a lot about monsters elsewhere. We should clarify that.
Yeah, once again, that's another kind of parallel with some of the Russian tales, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? That, by the way, the ice clinks you're hearing are Dr. Professor Stevens' ice and a beautiful bourbon he has here in this wonderful den he's been kind enough to invite me to.
Mm-hmm. Elijah Craig, I'm not sponsored by him, but I do enjoy it.
Hey, if Elijah Craig CEOs are out there, feel free to sponsor the Monster Professor. That's a parallel with some of the Russian folklore too, with Koski the Deathless and mm-hmm. stuff. And wait, before we get to that, I want to get to that. But so when some of these like more Western tradition writers, like Algernon Blackwood, they're writing about, you know, encounters with Wendigo in like Canada or different parts of America, United States of America, there's a sense that there's like this, they sometimes call them like wind walker spirits, and then they're like, they'll follow their tracks on the ground, but then the tracks will lift off the ground, mm-hmm, they'll like mm-hmm. possess other men, mm-hmm. and there's this sense of like burning feet, and one guy who gets mm-hmm. possessed mm-hmm. or snatched up by the Wendigo or transforms into him in this doppelganger way, it's not clear, he's screaming above the trees that his feet are burning. My mm-hmm. God, my God, the burning of my feet. And I'm like, what's up with that? Is there some like connection? Was there some Sasquatch Wendigo connection, a Bigfoot footprint thing? Or do you have any insight on this burning mm-hmm. feet thing?
I wish I did. I really don't. But that image of feet going out and then suddenly stopping is actually, in the stories that I've read, it's tied to a monster bird. And there's in among the Ojibwe and the Cree and these other northern tribes, they have stories of these monster birds that will come down and swoop up a person. Huh. And a lot of the times that you go out there and you'll see somebody's tracks that's missing, and you'll follow the tracks through the snow, and then all of a sudden they stop, and then the assumption there is they've been taken off by a monster bird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
The burning feet, I haven't come across that yet. Maybe we'll have to do another episode where maybe I can dig up something and find that. But I haven't found any of that yet in the stories I've read.
Huh. So no clear connection to like Sasquatch stuff and then Wendigo then, I guess. It's Wendigo.
You know, there are lots of giant sort of hairy monsters,
yeah,
in Native American folklore, but I haven't come across that with the Wendigo specifically, although that's, you know, going back to that X-Men comic, that's one thing that you think about when you think about a Wendigo.
Yeah.
But that's not what I've come across. And one person that's kind of given a modern take on the Wendigo is Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's a contemporary writer who's a botanist. And she writes about science and also about Native American traditions. And she herself is a Potawatomi. And she has a beautiful essay. She's a wonderful writer. And she talks about the Wendigo. And the way she makes sense of the Wendigo is the Wendigo is a person who has been transformed through greed and hunger and stinginess into a monster. And the more that creature eats, the hungrier he gets.
Ah.
And she uses this as a beautiful symbol for what we are as a people now, that is constantly obsessed with consumption. And the more we gobble up, the more we want. And for her, the modern version of a Wendigo is the corporation, you know, this greedy thing that takes everything into itself and leaves nothing but the desire for more and more and more. And it's a powerful way that that story's been transformed.
Huh. Well, then that might, I guess that might make some sense there with the connection with cannibalism or like eating other people. It's like, what more visceral image do you need necessarily of like, you know, this ravenous like hunger along with greed and taking mm-hmm. advantage mm-hmm. of others than eating too much of other human beings, I guess, which also must have been a reality where it gets cold in the north. You know, it might be just easier to eat your neighbors than go out hunting, you know, dozens, hundreds of miles away for a herd.
Yeah, you know, imagine yourself in the wilderness in February up in northern Canada, you know, and what happens if you suddenly sprain your ankle or break your leg? You're not able to hunt anymore, and yet you still have to provide for yourself and your family, and starvation is a real possibility. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, cannibal monsters do show up across the North America, but I think it's especially important up there. And for me, it's when I think about the Wendigo, I often think of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Right. And what you see there is a father and a son, and what are they doing? They're symbolically carrying the fire. You know, what are they carrying? They're carrying human civilization. That is that idea of compassion and care for another human being. And what's on the outside is that darkness. And you see these human beings, which are not really human beings. These are cannibals. They come from the darkness and they look just like us. Yeah. And yet they will do these hideous things. And I think most deeply when I read these Wendigo stories, I think about Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
Yeah. Like, well, that gets us into, well, it's maybe not us, it's taken me to some dark places too, because how many of those, like Jeffrey Dahmer, how many people have you, you know, heard, or, you know, even people who knew him or were kind of friends with him in high school will say, like, there's essentially, sooner or later, you get a sense that you're not dealing with a real person anymore. Mm-hmm. There's this uncanny valley drop off. Mm-hmm. And then those are also the people associated with cannibalism.
Mm-hmm. And, so, you know, what
maybe
more?
Jeffrey Dahmer is a Wendigo then in that sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, and you just have that, you know, I think the image that struck you is also the same image that struck me, is you have a person sitting there down at the fire, but he's turned towards the darkness.
Yeah.
And that is a perfect image of what the Wendigo represents.
So, rough transition back to this Russia, this parallel with some of these Russian tales. And I think I've mentioned this to, like this detail in a Russian Baba Yaga story on an earlier episode of The Monster Professor, in which, okay, so the Russian tale goes essentially this girl is fleeing the Baba Yaga, this witch, and as she's fleeing, because of other favors she's done or gifts that she's been given, she has these like little tricks to slow down the Baba Yaga, and one of the things she does is throw something behind her, and like a mirror, or in a different version, it's like a towel, and it suddenly becomes like this huge lake. And so the Baba Yaga has to like paddle across it or find some way across it. And then she'll throw something else behind her, like a comb or something, and it becomes this huge forest that the Baba Yaga has to like cut through or chew her way through. And then you've told me before this podcast, so I want to get you on record for this kind of thing. You told me this tale from Native America that has some of those features.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been like burning my mind ever since. So tell me, how are they similar? What's that tale?
Yeah, you know, a little before I say that, you know, that's one of the things I appreciate about having conversations with you, is that you have this expansive knowledge of these folklore from various parts of the world, and I have to say I'm pretty limited in my knowledge of that, and finding these parallels between these stories that I'm reading and other stories that you have read is really one of the magical things about it is that you find that these stories are hitting something because they are told the world over. And what you're talking about is a good example of that. There's a story from the Blackfeet Indians in which a young woman has been having an affair with a wolf, or not a wolf, but a bear. And her little sister finds out that she's been having an affair with a bear, and she exposes it, which was a very poor decision on her part. And so the bear witch older sister decides she wants to take revenge upon her sister as well as her six brothers. And so she ends up that the bear that she had been having an affair with is murdered, and the sister then begins pursuing the rest of her siblings in bear form. And one of the brothers has a cup of water that he picks up and he throws behind him, and it turns into a vast lake. And the bear witch sister, whatever you want to call her, ends up getting around that, and they go up a little bit further, and the brother throws behind a porcupine tail, which would have been used as a comb, and he throws that behind, and it turns into a thicket, and she has to get around that as well, and it ends up with the children all climbing a tree, and the they have to shoot arrows at the sister and so forth, and they wind up becoming the stars of the Big Dipper, which I'll get back to here in a second. But it is really, I remember reading that after I had read the Baba Yaga story that you had told, and a little bit of a side note on that. The first time I ever read the Baba Yaga story was a little story that we have in our house that we read to our children, and it's called Bony Legs. And yeah, again, I don't know much of my Russian folklore except from this one children's story. And I remember reading that to my kids and just being completely stunned by it, like blown away by how powerful this little kid story is. And what made it so powerful was the fact that this is a story from an authentic tradition. You know, this is not a story just made up by some modern storyteller. This is somebody reaching back into the deep history of their people and telling the story. And that's one of the reasons why I love so much these Native American stories, is that the fact that these stories exist tells us that these stories have power and meaning.
Yeah.
Stories that are not meaningful or not powerful don't get passed on. Yeah. And so it always lends this credence to these stories that pay attention to this. You know, there is something special into this. If you have seen this story show up in this one Indian tribe and a very similar story shows up in another tribe and another tribe, that's telling you there's something in this that's powerful. That's the essence of literature in my point of view, is that something that has power and has been passed down through the ages. And back to this story, the parallels are quite evident. You know, you have a witch pursuing a little girl, and she throws behind a mirror, which becomes a lake. She throws behind a comb, which becomes a thicket. And that's exactly what we saw in the Blackfeet story. And what I find even more powerful about this is the fact that what is the Big Dipper but a portion of the constellation Ursa Major,
which is the great female
bear.
Yeah.
And so here you have a story that eventually comes from Greek mythology, but it's about Ursa Major, a great female bear. And here you have the Blackfeet Indians, which is a tribe that lives in modern day Montana, and they also have some tribes that live up in Canada, and they're still telling a story about how this constellation came about by a great female bear. Right. It doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, okay, so how the hell did it get on? Because you've got, I mean, what, the when people were crossing the Bering Strait from like Russia to like North America, like 20,000 years ago, were they bringing this story? Or is it something like, you know, is Jung onto it? Like, you know, it's not carried with us necessarily in tradition. Like, maybe it's written into our brains. And like, what's going on with this
thing? And that's, you know, that's, I think any way that you answer it, it comes to the same conclusion. So, number one, the story was something that was passed down for 20,000 years, 30,000 years, whatever you want to have it. Yeah. That sounds ludicrous, but I think it is a legitimate possibility. Another possibility is that this is hitting some sort of archetype, you know, such as we see in Jung. And this is getting to the essence of humanity. And we might not fully understand it now, but it's telling us that this is something extremely powerful. This is something to pay attention to. You know, as a side note, you could say, well, maybe the Blackfeet Indian had come across some sort of Russian folklore during the historical period.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a possibility as well. Seems to me very unlikely, but even if that were true, it's still getting to the same essential point, is that there's something in this story that you need to pay attention to.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about it. Like, what does it mean to throw this thing? Like, you're being pursued by something bad, right? And so something behind you is chasing you, but you throw this thing behind you that is essentially, it's essentially something reflective. And so you have this kind of reflection in your past or behind you. And then you throw this forest behind you. And almost every tale that I know of from, you know, whatever's the newest Netflix TV show to as old a story as you can find, when a character's in a forest, you're lost, you're losing your way. It's a dreamland, sleepy land, you can't tell who you are, where you are. And so there's this sense of getting lost in a deep forest. And so tossing this thing behind you of lack of direction, tossing this thing behind you that's reflection. I don't know if that would be... Oh, who knows? I don't know what the story means. Maybe that's a start.
You know, I mean, I think it is a start. And again, I don't claim to have any of the deep mystical meanings of these things. From a just a everyday point of view, I often focus on the fact that these are stories told by people to an audience. And if you're sitting in a wigwam or you're sitting in a teepee, what are the things that you might have around you? And what can you pick up and tell a little story with?
Yeah.
And so you might have a comb laying around. You might have your little gourd filled with water. And you can turn that object that you have right in front of you into a storytelling element. And there's another Kickapoo story that is very similar to that, where there's the hero that is running away from a giant. A giant had killed his parents, and he wanted to have revenge on the giant that killed his parents. And that was a very foolish thing to do because, you know, it's a giant after all. And so he decides he's going to go off, and he encounters a woman out there in the woods, if you will. And she gives him several items, and he encounters the giant. He lives with him for a while. He ends up cutting off the heads of the giant's sons, and then the giant decides he wants to get revenge upon him. And there's a wonderful story. We both know He-Man, and the giant is actually riding upon a lion. And I think that's a quite interesting detail. And so the giant is pursuing him on a lion, and so he throws behind these four objects. There's a flint and steel. There is a shoe peg, there is a whetstone, and then there is one other item, I forget what it is, but it does the exact same thing, where it produces a barrier between him and his pursuer. And so, you know, I think about it from the storyteller perspective of saying, what are the things around me, how can I shape that into to a story? And there's that kind of practical everyday thing, but as we all know, there's probably deeper meanings in it as well.
And I'll tell you what direction I want to go. I want to ask you about thunderbirds. Because that's another one. If I'm going, you know, what immediately comes to mind for monsters of Native America, and I'm thinking like thunderbirds. And then I found out that it's not just a tale of these giant birds swooping down and snatching up people. Like, they have their own, thunderbirds have their own, like, cultural problems with other monsters, you're telling me. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what's going on in Thunderbird world.
You know, let me just pick up on something that you mentioned there, is that this is something that I've found really refreshing in a lot of these stories is that a lot of the times in our European-derived culture, which is heavily influenced by Christianity, the world is shaped into good and evil.
Yeah.
And a lot of these stories, when you go into them with that notion of these good and evil beings, it doesn't always work out that way. And I think the best modern equivalent of that is the Miyazaki films. Yeah. And I think about Princess Mononoke, and I love that film so much because you have so many different interested parties with motives all of their own, and not a single one of them is the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yes, lots of them end up doing lots of bad things, but they do them for good reasons.
Yeah.
Because they are trying to live their life in the way that they see fit. And I think a lot goes into understanding that the world doesn't break down into good and evil.
Yeah.
That you have these interested parties in different ways. And
those Miyazaki, I mean, he's like, his storytelling is really connected with what would be essentially indigenous culture and folktale with the Shinto stuff. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, Spirited Away, mm-hmm, Totoro, Princess Mononoke. So.
Yeah, and it's just for me, a really refreshing take on reality, because it fundamentally shifts the way you see the world. Is that the world is not organized for these people in terms of good forces and evil forces.
Yeah.
Even the evil things have their benefits to the people. And, you know, there's lots of stories where the Indians will seek to harvest parts of the water monster because it's going to help them with their war. And it might not entirely be good, but it is good in terms of defeating your enemy.
Yeah.
But back to the Thunderbirds, I mean, Thunderbirds is a topic that is so kind of difficult because what do we think of when we think of Thunderbird? I think we think of cars, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You know, we think of something...
I think of monsters, but I think most American guys would think of cars.
We think of cars, and we think of something that's kind of a cliched image, yeah, of North America,
yeah,
traditions, and yet,
yeah, I felt stereotypical bringing up Thunderbirds, but except that I know that there's no such thing as just a surface level stereotype if it's a monster in a folktale, like, mm-hmm, it's deep. And,
yeah, and so the story of the Thunderbird, there's many different versions of it, and I don't think it's possible to really zoom in on anything that is the one authentic tale, but what I would say is that the Thunderbirds are beings associated with storms, and they are often imagined as winged creatures, although many times they show up as human beings and just regular human beings, but they are nevertheless these creatures that create thunderstorms. Huh. And almost universally, I would say, they are always dangerous but benevolent to human beings. And there's lots of explanations for why they are benevolent to human beings. It often turns into how the humans have helped them, the Thunderbirds, with their battle against the water monsters. And there's a lot of mythology with the Thunderbirds. Among the Lakota, for example, a person who has actually seen a Thunderbird, either in actuality or in a vision, and there's plenty of gray area between those two things, they become Heyoka. And what Heyoka means among the Lakota is a person who is backwards, crazy, not quite right in the way they do things. And there's a lot to the whole notion of Heyoka, but one aspect of it is, when I think of it, I often think of the fool in Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah.
The fool in Shakespeare's plays is the person who acts like a nut and yet is able to tell the truth when the whole world is crazy. And so the Heyoka are these people that will defamiliarize you from your ordinary experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, they will walk backwards. They will perform ceremonies in reverse. So, for example, if you're in a sweat lodge, you always perform things, as we say, clockwise. The Heyoka might perform things counterclockwise. They will come across a puddle of water and think that it's a giant ocean that they must cross. they build crooked arrows. They do all things in an awkward, strange way. And what that does is it forces you to see things from a fresh perspective.
Yeah. And so, and this is for those people who have had a vision of Thunderbirds, who have actually seen them or encountered them, and they, this is what happens to them.
And that's exactly right. Yeah.
Alice in Wonderland kind of.
They become Hayoka. And, you know, what that means, again, it means many different things, but the idea is that you become a clown. And you might not want to be a clown for all your life, and there are ways to come back to what we would call normal reality, but that is the power of the Thunderbirds, is that they change your perspective on things.
And okay, and so they're helping human beings fight water monsters. And so do like the Thunderbirds have beef with the water monsters, mm-hmm. and vice versa? Or what's up with that?
Yeah, this is a story that's told all across North America, where the Cherokee tell stories of these Thunderbirds fighting the water monsters. The Central Algonquians tell stories. The Lakota, as I mentioned, tell these stories, and they always have this antipathy with the water monsters. And the water monsters are always imagined as giant snakes with feet, usually. And they live in deep pools of water in the rivers. Sometimes they are imagined as giant water creatures that stretch the whole length of a river. And here I'm thinking of the Miyazaki story, Spirited Away, in which the water
dragon.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, in the Dragons and Serpents episode, I think I don't remember how much we got into it, but that constant association with serpents and water and underwater dragons. And don't they call them isn't there an underwater panther or something
absolutely,
like that?
Isn't
that another kind of version of a serpent dragon like thing?
Yeah, it is. And the Cherokee have a wonderful story about the Uktini, as they describe it. And it's even that root word Uk shows up in all these tribes that have very different languages, but yet that phoneme, or whatever you want to call it, is shows up in all these languages. And among the Cherokee, the Uktini has a crystal in its forehead. And if you're able to get a hold of this crystal, it's going to give you extraordinary power. And that's a good example of how, even though these things are imagined as evil creatures, they can actually do you quite a bit of benefit depending on how you use them. And a person who is able to get the crystal from the head of this Uktini will keep it. And the rules, as I've read in James Mooney's Myth of the Cherokees, is that you wrap it in a complete deer skin. And then you take that deer skin and you put it into a clay vessel. And then you take that vessel and you put it into a cave in the mountains. And you have an obligation to feed it once a week with small game. And so you might kill a squirrel or a raccoon and then bathe that crystal in blood.
Huh.
And then once a year, if I'm correct, you will need to bathe it in the blood of a larger animal, like a deer or something like that. And if you perform the proper protocol, that's going to give you extraordinary power. And if you don't do it, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, okay. So you have tales of people essentially tearing treasures away from dragons once again.
And let me just follow up with that. We all know the story from The Hobbit that you have to hit the dragon where the scale is missing.
Yeah, and every dragon has this weak spot, whether it's Fafnir under his belly or Smaug and that one's missing scale.
And among both the Lakota as well as the Cherokee, there's the seventh spot from the head. And that is its one weak spot that you can hit.
Huh.
And I think that's quite remarkable. This past summer, I went out to the Giant Serpent Mound in Ohio, which was a truly wonderful experience. It was more powerful than I thought it would be. And I realized walking along that Giant Serpent Mound in Ohio is that there are seven undulations to the serpent.
Huh.
And I thought, my goodness, what a wonderful coincidence that you have the seventh spot and then you have the seven undulations of the of the serpent.
Yeah, and or not a coincidence, probably.
Not a coincidence, because I almost believe that the giant serpent mound is a type of calendar, because what do you have but what is the typical lunar month? 28 days, which is 7 times 4, and 4 is always a sacred number among the Native Americans, and so you have 7 times 4 equals 28, and so I imagine these ancient people might have had some ritual that marked the calendar by this giant serpent mound, but that's my own speculation.
Well, and if nothing else, I like to leave Monster Professor listeners with some pragmatic advice. So if you're in North America and you encounter a water dragon, now you know how to kill it. Look for
that. My advice would be to run away.
Oh, okay, never mind. Do the runaway part.
To show respect to it and run away is what I would do. But, you know, to each his own.
So, I haven't warned you I'm going to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you this. Who's your favorite monster? How about we'll just narrow it down to who's your favorite monster? Who's your favorite monster from Native America?
Okay, well, let me answer that by saying, rephrasing your question, you know, which is the monster that has freaked me out the most?
Okay, I'm good with that. Was that a monster right there on the rooftop?
That was a, believe it or not, an acorn falling on our metal roof.
Oh.
It sounds like a hickory nut, but I know it has to be an acorn because the hickory tree doesn't stretch that far. A white oak, by the way, if you're interested.
White oak is good, particularly fighting monsters, vampires, because white oak is for healing. No. Yeah,
it is.
White
it
oak is for healing. Yeah. Red oak is for building.
Absolutely, right? That's okay. Right. Yeah. Right. And there's it's the staff of life.
Yeah, even Hellboy had a white oak round. So some of my characters in my book, The Black Palace, have white oak rounds and 12 gauge. So the monster that freaked you out the most.
Yeah, and that's I think that's one of the things we look for. I mean, I think your listeners are looking for that exact thing, is that what is the thing that freaks you out? And you want to know why it freaks you out.
Yeah.
And for me, I think that the story that I first encountered that really just unsettled me for a long time, and I'm still unsettled by it, is a Cheyenne story about the rolling head. And I'll tell you one version of the story in which a husband suspects that his wife is being unfaithful. And so he says, I'm going to go out hunting. But instead, he doesn't go out hunting. Instead, he spies on his wife. And he watches his wife go to a lake. And a water monster, an Uctini of some type, comes out of the water. And there's this wonderful image of the water monster licking the woman, specifically on her face, and she had painted herself red, and that was something that the husband had actually done before he had left. He had painted his wife in red, and he saw his wife having this affair with the water monster. Of course, he's not happy with this, so he makes known what he knows, and he cuts off his wife's head. And then that, you know, that's straightforward enough. But after he does that, then he takes the body back, or parts of the body, I should say, and feeds it to their children. Which is, again, this is one of those details that I'm baffled by. Like, why does he do that? And as the children are eating the flesh of their mother, in rolls their mother's head that had been cut off by the husband. And I find it interesting that the mother is not particularly interested in the husband who cut off her head, but in the children who have been eating her flesh. And so the children run away. And this is another story in which you have a brother and a sister, and they don't have any items with them. But as they're running away from their mother's rolling head that's pursuing them, the sister says, I remember that there used to be a thicket of rose bushes here. And as she says that, a thicket of rose bushes appears. Huh. And then this keeps going on. She says, you know, I remember there was a thicket of blackberries or whatever it might have been. And there's another thicket that appears. And so we,
the memory makes it real.
The memory makes it real. And this daughter has the ability to speak things into being. And you have to wonder at her magical powers. Where did they come from? You know, maybe they didn't come from the father. Maybe they came from the mother who has this association with a water monster.
Yeah.
And eventually they run away and they get to another group of people. And the father comes and says that they are bad people that have eaten their mother's flesh. Which
is it's ratting them out.
Totally, yeah. You initially have sympathy for the father here because, yeah. You know, it's understandable. He's not happy with his wife having an affair with a water monster. But again, you get the sense that dad's not a very good guy either. And he rats out the children. And they are essentially excommunicated from the tribe, and they have to go off and live on their own, and the rolling head continues to pursue them.
Oh my God.
At one point the daughter says, I remember there used to be a mighty chasm right here. And as she says that, the chasm opens up and the mother's head disappears into that, and it has a wonderful happy ending where the short of it is the sister says, I wish that we had two pet bears to defend us. And lo and behold, two pet bears appear to defend the children. And then they eventually are able to harvest some buffalo, and they're able to give it to that group of people that had originally excommunicated them. And so they're able to live happily ever after. The rolling head, that was the first time I had ever read that type of story, and I was just, what an image. You know, your mother's decapitated head is pursuing you. How powerful is that? Freud, listen. I don't know what to make of it, but it's a powerful image. And
it's terrifying.
It is terrifying. I'm just, even describing it, it just freaks me out. But there's also many different stories from the Wintu, and I think they live in northern California, and they tell a story in which a woman or a girl is having her first menstruation, and somehow when she's excluded in her hut where the women would go for their moon period, she pricks her finger and she ends up drinking her blood from her finger, and she likes the taste of it, and so she sucks a little bit more, and then she ends up eating her finger. And she's like, oh, that's good. So she eats her arm, and then she keeps eating her body until she eats everything, until she's nothing but a head. And then she terrorizes her village as this rolling head. And just like with the Cheyenne story, she's only able to be not necessarily destroyed, but put away when one of the people holds out a rope across the river. And when the rolling head is halfway across the river, the person pulls the rope and she falls into the river and is swept away.
Huh.
And there's other stories of that where the witch or the rolling head is pursuing people, and she gets halfway across the river, and then whatever bridge she's using to get across there is taken away from her. She's always swept away from the river. And wow. So you have this wonderful, you know, symbolism, whatever you want to call it, of the river and the mother's head and the pursuing some sort of wrong perceived.
But you can't destroy it. You have to just, like, mm-hmm. get it away mm-hmm. and let it fall away or get swept away then.
Yeah. Huh.
Terrifying.
It is quite terrifying. The Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, also tell a story of a decapitated head in which the head has wings. And there's I think it's the Kickapoo that have a story too of a bodiless head. And that's kind of an interesting one where the husband cuts off the head of his wife, and yet she still performs all the wifely duties. She goes and she sets up the camp. She gathers the firewood. She does everything that a good wife would do among these people. Her only stipulation is, don't let anybody see me do it.
Huh.
Huh. And as you can imagine, some curious boy is really interested in this this man that has this being that performs all these duties for him. And so he spies it. And when she realizes that the boy has spied her, she freaks out and she terrorizes the whole tribe. And there's that aspect of mania or hysteria, if you will, going back to the mother sickness.
Wow.
Some deep, powerful stuff there.
I'm going to totally rip that off for a short story, by the way.
I hope you do. I mean, I think it needs to be retold. And that's
just modern America. Well, I tell you what, I'm sure we are well past, oh my God, yeah, we are well past time. Man, thank you so much for coming on the Monster Professor, talking about the monsters of Native America. This has been a blast. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much.